Hey, you. Yes, you. Thanks for listening to this station. We're a not-for-profit organization dedicated to our community and you, the listener. We're able to operate because of the funds raised by our communities, but that's often not enough. We're asking you for help, which you can do by contacting your federal member of parliament, call or write, and ask them to support the development of a community broadcasting fund and extend the local journalism initiative. Learn more at ncra.ca/help. And thanks for listening.
Hello. Welcome to Amanda Radio. I'm Doug Miller here at CQTE 90.3 FM, Montreal. Tonight's show is brought to you by our old friend and comrade, Tane Drousse from Manga Bay platform, news platform. Manga Bay is a nonprofit environmental science and conservation news platform that produces reporting in a number of languages, including English, Indonesian, Spanish, French, Hindi, and Brazilian Portuguese. They focus on forests, wildlife, oceans, and the conservation sector, and have a variety of different formats in which they produce it. They do get widely read, and Tane Drousse is their English editor, based. Tane is an old friend and a comrade. He's been a journalist and a radio producer, and in his own words, a bad student and a great editor. He's been a short order cook and a media trainer, and still occasionally plays as the right footed left back. He's worked in defense of people and the environment against Shell in Nigeria, in support of indigenous rights against hydropower in northern Manitoba, and for diversity and community-controlled food systems everywhere. He's suspicious of milk, chocolate, acronyms, and words with more than three syllables. He throws his hands up in disgust after Copenhagen, but can't escape the fact that the question of climate change demands careful answers to all the most urgent challenges facing the world today. He's lived longest in Canada and Nigeria, but now lives in Cape Town. Tane promised to produce a show for this week, and then he got a chance to come to the UN Biodiversity Conference, COP15, and pull this show together while en route, a massive and epic task. He indicated I'd be happy with it, and sure enough, he knew how to tickle this old man's fancy. He's pulled together an interview with the late Dr. Tandika Mkandawiri, one of Africa's foremost critical economists and a Malawian by origin, another one of the many brilliant minds produced by Malawi who had to leave the repression of their homeland during the days of the brutal dictator Kamuzu Banda. Tandika provides a critique of the economic profession and how it fails to serve Africa and what hope lies ahead. Thanks, Tane, for an enjoyable listen, and stay tuned for it. We really appreciate your view from Cape Town and your sharp analysis. I'll see you before you return to the Cape. By the way, the COP17 conference starts today and goes till 19 December, ostensibly to fail to deal to agree on a new set of goals to guide global action through 2030 to halt and reverse nature loss. Just like the COP27, get that, 17 comes after 27, which occurred in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, a few weeks back, it also failed to deal with how to prevent the disastrous consequences of fossil fuel-driven climate change. I hope Tane will be able to give us insight to what he learned at COP17 the next time he contributes. Stay tuned to Amanda.
Probably the graph of the American Depression and then the African Depression. And it, I was struck by the fact that the African Depression was deep, if not deeper than the American Depression. History matters, you know? It matters a lot. You know?
So I don't know about you, but even on the sweetest of days when the rains are on time and Tiwa Savage has a new album out and the members of CAF are easing UEFA luminaries out of a tournament somewhere, It nags at me that Africa is somehow still very much on the back foot, off balance. I was listening to an interview with the late, great Malawian economist Tandika Mkandawire, and he stuck his fingers right into that tender place. He was talking to Laura Mann, also at the LSE, about Africa's Great Depression. 2 decades of economic crisis stretching from the onset of the debt crisis in the 1980s until it finally eased somewhat, and only for some, with the commodity supercycles of the early 2000s. He goes on a wide-ranging discussion that focuses on how this narrowed and weakened the study and practice of economics across our continent, and how this weakness has in turn left African policymakers even less able to find the answers to the many, many challenges that we face. Now, you're thinking that you don't really want to listen to someone talk about how Africa's economists have fared over the past 40 years, but trust me, Mkandawire is the best company. Plus, as dessert, we'll take a moment to listen to Kenyan policy analyst Nanjira Sambuli talk about data and development in Africa.
We need all states to go back to being custodians of the public interest, right?
Yeah. In for a nerd penny and in for a nerdier pound on Amandla this week, but she's a treat too. Stay tuned. It's CKUT 90.3 FM.
That. I plotted a graph of the American Depression and then the African Depression, and I was struck by the fact that the African Depression was deep, as deep as, if not deeper than the American Depression, but it definitely lasted longer. Mm-hmm. And this deep, or five, six-year dip in the U.S. was called the Great American Depression. Mm-hmm. And ours has been going on for 20 years, and mm-hmm. it is not called a Great Depression, and the recent recession is called a Great Recession. It lasted 2 years, 2-3 years. So words matter, you know, that maybe the choice of words that were used by the African crisis somehow tended to downplay the disaster that occurred. You know? Mm-hmm. It was a major disaster, but, you know. And I
think that language... Tandika Mkandawire was chair of African development at the London School of Economics, and along with Laura Mann, also an LSE professor, who studies digitalization, actually, of agriculture in California and Kenya. The two of them take a tour of the falling and sometimes rising tide for academics and academia. They take it to some interesting places.
If you go to most African universities, the old ones, one thing that immediately strikes you is that the founders of these universities had lots of faith in them, and they built quite impressive infrastructure. You can see these old buildings, they're really very impressive. And then came the financial crisis, and then the World Bank's position, and there was a dramatic fall. You know, I remember one of the cases that I can never forget was in going to a library in Ivory Coast, and there were no books anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. And that regression of our institutions, you know, is still there. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. some universities, there have been some rebuilding, cleaning up the walls. I mean, I was very impressed with the University of Ghana, you know. Mm-hmm. They've done a lot of, you know. But we've lost these years, you know. When you think about the loss of this Great Depression, that it's not that we went down and then came up. You have to think how much was lost and how long it would take just to get back that loss, you know? Mm-hmm. And we're very far from doing that. And it did something which has turned out to be very difficult to reverse. There was a massive brain drain. I had written a paper once about the 3 generations of Africans. Mm-hmm. The first generation, post-colonial generation, they went abroad. I belong to that generation. We went in the 60s to study abroad. Mm-hmm. And some of the older ones, by the end of the 60s, were coming back to constitute the first African professoriate, if you like. The second generation went in the 70s, went to the U.S. mostly, came back, and just as soon as they came back, the crisis hit, they left and went back. The third generation never came back. The fourth generation is now being trained in African universities. Mm-hmm. And fairly difficult conditions, and sometimes you can look at the faculty structure. You have old professors who are retiring, mm-hmm. and then junior faculty. There's nothing in between here, mm-hmm. because those 2 generations didn't come back. I think African governments didn't react intelligently to what was happening, because they could have probably done what I understand China does, to say, okay, so you're in America, we know you're settled there, but we want to buy at least 2 months of your time a year to come and teach here. Or, we didn't do that. Now there are a lot of new schemes. I think Carnegie has been involved in one of the schemes where they're asking faculty abroad to either mentor faculty, students at home, or to, so we could have, with the new technologies, it allows a little bit of that, that we could exploit the time of some of the scholars abroad. And many of them, you can exploit their bad conscience by, because they would like to do something useful, They'd be willing to, if you gave them a ticket and a bedroom somewhere to live on for 3 months, they would teach.
So like emotional resource mobilization.
Yes. Really use all your moral incentives, Many governments in the world, kind of Israel and India, and they're doing that. They're accepting that their scholars are now resident. But Africa is a very populous continent, so they say, oh, no, you left the continent, you betrayed the continent, so that was it.
Now, I'll admit that I'm not so sure that it's the best idea to call on non-resident Africans and the diaspora intelligentsia to call them home to mentor a new generation, to be honest. I am more than a little suspicious of how the intellectual spectrum in the colonizing countries where so much African talent has taken refuge or embedded itself. I'm suspicious of how this is narrowed. Mkandawire actually comes back to this later. We can only fit so much into the hour, so I skip past something that he says about the painful loss of a cohort who could have documented Africa's Great Depression in much better detail if they were not absent. And he says that this lack, this gap, is still shaping how we think and act. It's shaping how we are able to think and act. And again, I'm suspicious here that this is true maybe for scholars and policymakers and maybe for would-be corporate types, but I wonder if this concern overlooks an organic intellectual base here. If it skips past people who are wrestling with problems using fewer syllables, working a bit closer to the ground with the material day-to-day things front and center, which is not to say that these same people can't see the horizon. But the point that he's making is that not only is Africa missing a lot of careful documentation and analysis of what happened to us between the 1980s and the start of the millennium, he's saying that when it comes to economists, we're basically the high priests of our time, Africa is actually missing the kinds of economists that we need, have been missing them.
Economics, I think of all the social sciences, has, by describing, by giving itself this aura of being scientific, actually constrained everybody, including in the developed countries, You have a very strange discourse about everything. Yeah, of course it's not realistic. Yeah, of course we missed out the last crisis. Mm-hmm. We admit all these things that we are not managing well. But then the quotation mark scientific requirements suggest that we should close our eyes to these untheorized realities, Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's a general problem. I don't think it's an African problem. Just that in Africa it was felt much more sharply because there were a number of people involved, and the issues at stake were great issues at stake. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine the whole 20 years of Africa's depression, the focus was on stabilization and efficient allocation of resources, nothing was said of mobilization of resources. So the only thing like that was really strange, that you would have thought that growth and structural change, the old economics, whatever one says about it, was focused on those things, growth and structural change. We may not have analyzed it properly, but the focus was definitely correct. And now, of course, it's come back. It's a big thing now, structures, structures. And our economists were not studying those things.
So do you think still today?
Now, I'm the first to admit that I'm as dumb as the next doorknob about the finer points of economics, and out of my depth the moment the first name or theory drops. I do think that my mistrust has roots in feeling as though so much of what economists say about Africa, well, actually about anywhere, seems quite blind to what's actually happening while they exercise their models.
Mm. But you're saying that there's not enough data points being collected at the moment to really have a model of what is happening within African economies or African societies to be able to model it in a kind of scientific way?
Yeah, Well, this is not only about Africa. I mean, the very fact that economists could not predict the crisis in Europe just tells you that they don't have a model. You know, in the old days, we spent a lot of time studying cycles and, you know, Kondratiev cycles, and it looks silly, but actually, that's what will help you predict things, you know? Mm. These very crude cycles and things happening. You know? So we went on these very refined models where the whole reality is removed with zero predictive value, you know?
Yeah.
That's how we are now. So it's not just about, it's just that the economics, I think, has a problem, you know, in the sense of...
But I guess in African countries, there's less investment in knowledge infrastructures generally.
Yes.
And so you have even less data, you know, like maybe even the models are deficient because even in an environment like Britain, where there's all sorts of surveillance of one kind of another, they're still getting...
You know, this is a big problem in Africa. I mean, I've written a little bit about that, that... Most societies have, the state has some kind of organic link with some intellectuals, part of the intelligentsia who are part of the state. You know, like in Britain, you know, all these LSEs, Oxfords, you know, they're part of the establishment. Okay? Mm. And many of the members of staff here, they mix quite well with this thing. Mm. In Africa, that never grew up. That relationship between the state and its universities, only in South Africa, when the Afrikaner regime had universities like Stellenbosch and Pretoria, University of Pretoria and all that, those were part of the apartheid regime, and they helped write the laws and design the cities, you know, all those things. African leaders, all of them had expatriates as advisors, including the great ones like Nkrumah, you know, and Nyerere and all that. They all had expatriates. They had very bad relationship with their universities. And when I read about the French... During the 1968 riots, Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher, was leading one of the groups. So the chief of the commissioner of police called Charles de Gaulle and says, "Look, Jean-Paul Sartre is leading this. Should we arrest him?" And de Gaulle said, "No, you can't arrest France. You know, this man is France. You know, this intellectual is France. That is amazing. We don't have that."
No. If somebody tried to arrest you in Malawi...
Oh, they'd be happy. They'd kill him. I actually have written an article about that, this distance between the African intelligentsia and the state. So these most ridiculous problems, they'll bring an expert advisor who will then, if he's generous, go to university and hire some people's consultant to write a report, which he will then present to the government, and the government will be very happy. You know, that's it. And that, I don't know how to change that. Mbeki, when he was the president, he always attacked the black intellectuals in South Africa not coming up. You know, but actually, he wanted them to be praise singers for him. That's what Africans thought. When the Africans engaged with universities, they wanted to write a book praising the president, you know? But just the idea of imagining that these universities are kind of critical. My positive side of the story is that the numbers are increasing. The African universities, the quality may be suffering, but we're now talking of 8 million Africans going to universities, you know? That's big, you know? And it's the fastest growing university population in the world. And I think there's been a reversal in terms of the decline of quality in some of the key countries like Senegal, Gambia, and Ghana, and all that. You know, there's been a major reverse Tanzania. And with a little bit of a democracy and the, in a sense, the erosion of the leverage of the World Bank types, you know, there's more space. And you can see it from the novelist, basically, as usual in Africa. You start reading about our music and, you know, film. They are way out there, you know. Universities have been slow in that. I would argue, by the way, that, you know, it's one of those things, and I'm glad you're doing that, that I have some complaint in a number of places that nobody takes African thinking seriously. It need not be the correct. It need not be correct thinking. You know, it's not matter what it is. Just you have just know what it is. What are they thinking? And you know, if you don't know what they're thinking, one of these things the World Bank officials expressed to us many times, they could not understand that they never ceased being opposed by universities. So in that sense, the anti-structural adjustment people, we won the battle. They use muscle eventually and money, but in terms of legitimacy and conviction of, no, they never managed to convince us. And that puzzled them a lot. So they just said, okay, well, they are all African universities, they're ignorant, they have not traveled. Somebody even said, we have not traveled enough and all that. That's why we're against structural adjustment. They didn't acquire the kind of intellectual hegemony they thought they would over the university. They controlled the economics, of course.
I really enjoy the light gloss of pride with which he says that the World Bank never silenced its critics in Africa. Maybe he even overstates it a little. He does concede that many took the money. But what he describes, the strategy to take over the thinking and framing of a field, is something that you'll encounter also in the agriculture field. All over the continent, there are people trained by Borlaug and his descendants, from the Rockefeller Foundation down through Gates. They're running around, even now, preaching a green revolution for Africa, pivoting to climate-smart agriculture and looking down their noses at people with other visions, at visions rooted in the indigenous knowledge of local conditions and seeds, visions that maintain the sovereignty of farmers over food systems rather than commit themselves to industrial seeds and pesticides controlled by an ever smaller number of multinationals. And the absolute killer in that field is how the likes of Tim Wise and others have gone out to assess the benefits of all this modernization of African agriculture. And they find that it is failing virtually everywhere across the continent. But let's get back to Mkandawire on economists and economies.
Well, most African economies before structural adjustment were what people call structuralists. Okay? And then came the structural adjustment. The people who were running the structural adjustment felt, first of all, they were upset that they met opposition from the existing economists massively. I mean, almost all of them were against structural adjustment. So they decided to create their own economists. And they set up a network, the African Economic Research Consortium, to train in macroeconomics. Now, the tragedy of African training of economists is that it's been so, in a way, donor-driven. Even the first generation, we were supposed to be trained in planning methods. So you did the input-output, national income accounting. And then people went back in the 70s. They said, oh, no, well, what we need really is project evaluation managers. So new manuals were written on input, you know, on cost-benefit analysis and project evaluation. As soon as those people came back with their PhDs, you know, they were told, no, the issue is stabilization. So they set up this network, produced a lot of people to stabilize economies. Now, normally stabilization doesn't need many people. You need one man and the Minister of Finance and one of the Reserve Bank to devalue a currency, you know, that's it. So in the process, they specialized economists for sectors, whether transport economics and health economics, disappeared. You know, that training did not exist. Now that they're going back to project in industrialization and project, they are worrying about Africa has no project planners. We stopped training them in the 70s and the 80s. Even when they were having these PRSPs, which suggested some idea of a national economy, the donors themselves began to find that we don't have Africans who can write these documents. So the World Bank began writing them for us. They write for you and you approve it, and then they praise you for having written this wonderful document. But there is a big gap that we need. We don't have people who can write project documents, who can evaluate, you know, that small skill like that disappeared. You can read the donor documents now. They're panicking. They search for Africans who can write project proposals.
In the period where African countries were enjoying growth and enjoying kind of a surplus, was there not more of a kind of less donor-driven economic
The donors have nothing to do with universities. You know, universities are funded locally. When they wanted the economists for their project, they would train them, but that was specific. What happened in the 80s, they actually took over economics departments. You know, that's different. They actually started master's program, ran from a hotel, but for universities. So it was much more dramatic, yes. And that's why I think you can say that there is no lively debate in Africa, among economists, definitely not that young generation.
Do you think that in recent years...
Laura Mann asks him an interesting question about political science research in Africa. much of which she clearly finds to be a bit thin and unsatisfying. And Mkandawire does not need much of an invitation to play.
They start from the assumption that Africans have no ideology, okay? Mm. In the extreme, like Pokoli, they assume Africans are there because of greed, you know, or self-interest, whatever it is. So you start from there, then your ideas are not interesting, you know. If you tell some people being driven by all kinds of ideas of nationalism or, you know, as you want to call it, political imagination, those are denied right from the beginning by the assumption of, I assume a rational individual who's performing, you know, pursuing individual interest, blah, blah, blah. And that this person only gets into politics because he wants to, he or she wants to pursue this interest. That's it. It's the extreme form of materialism, you know. People tell they're against Marx because Marx is a materialist. I say, but you're worse. At least Marx accepted it was a superstructure, you know, of ideas, you know.
You know? I sometimes think the reason we don't have a way of you know, the political science is, to me, slightly unsatisfactory, is that people don't speak the languages that they're studying.
Yeah, that's another problem.
You know, that surely to know what people think, you have to be able to hear them.
Yeah. You know? Yes. Yeah. And I think the words, I just give an example in my country. The word for politics, the local word for politics, is so damning. Mm-hmm. It's ndalizadziko, which means tricks of the state. You know, mm-hmm. That's politics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's how they have understood. So whenever it means ndali, that's politics. It's seen negative. Eh? The word itself is negative. Mm-hmm. Unless you understand that, you ask, Africans like politics, but actually the word says that is negative, you know?
But then that would sort of lead you to think of a very cynical version of politics that is just about trickery.
Yes. And it came, this ironically, in Malawi anyway, I know the guy who coined the word, you know? Mm. It was at a rally in 1961, and there was a journalist at that time, and somebody said, he was translating from English, and he says, politics, and he says, politics, you know, and that is a zip, and that word stuck. You know? And Malawi tried to remove it, but it stuck, and gave a very bad impression of what politics is all about. And unfortunately, a lot of our key actors have confirmed the point that it's just tricks.
Yeah.
But you're right about the language, you know, that. But see, again, there's one guy who was writing on Malawi politics. He was not extreme, you know, because he was kind of postmodernist. Discourse analysis, so he knew the language very well. You know, he was a Finnish guy, and some of the stuff were really impressive. That because he would talk to people, local people, explain the same thing in their local language, and they would have a very different view from. Yeah. So that, in a sense, evidence how knowing the language makes a difference. But then you realize that the politics today, which is in looking for the views of this fragmented, isolated, rational in individuals, doesn't need language. You just know. You know, this guy is okay, he's in producing maize, so he's going to support a policy for maize, and that's it.
But do you think that's the way in which people vote?
One of the assumptions that some of the new research in Africa is showing, the earlier view that Africans vote for personal gain. Okay. And in practice, some politicians went around giving gifts during the campaign. In Malawi, it's interesting, Tony Blair sent a bunch of young people to advise Joyce Banda. And one of the things they advised her was to go around giving these prizes. And she lost the elections. Okay. And the guy who ran against him, there's one district he won big time. And he had not been there. He had been there only once to open a highway. Okay? And it was in the north, and he was from the south. And people voted overwhelmingly. So there is that evidence now growing up, showing that actually Africans do not vote. If you give them pennies and money, they won't vote for you. They'll get the money, but they won't vote for you. That they vote for public goods. You build a school, or build a bridge, or build a road. Some very good studies on Ghana. I think one thing is going to save social sciences are these mindless young researchers that run regressions on anything, you know, because they're disproving all these theories, you know, about how Africans vote, you know. I don't think they were intended to do that, but they just run a regression and say, actually, they don't vote according to what neo-patrimonialism says. They actually voted for very clear public good. Okay?
I love what he says there, talking about how Africans are treated as stick figures almost, lacking in complexity, as though the full muddy range of human motivations are not always and everywhere in play. Wrapping up, this pair of LSE professors look through the present towards the future.
Africa will use the internet very different. You watch this, you know, because in many ways we're skipping certain stages, right? I mean, I have my nieces, and they don't read newspapers, but they rely on internet, you know, for getting all kinds of discussions going. Sometimes they, you know, in their own little team, they do that. And they just need good bloggers, you know, to organize things for them, you know. And that's where Africa may go. Because Africa has to run while others walk, as I said. And we have to do that, you know. But I must say, you know, that I think this kind of work of just understanding or bringing out what Africans think. It's not a question of whether it's right or wrong. It's not important. It's just that these are the kinds of things that are worrying Africans. I think it's very important. It's very important. When I go to Africa, a lot of things surprise me in Africa, you know. Even here, some of the students who are from Africa, and when I talk to them, 15 years ago, I was in Nairobi, gave a lecture, and it was question time. And to my surprise, students knew almost everything I had read. where did you get the articles? You know, because your library is not working. He said, oh, no, there's no problem. You know, there's a man up there. You pay him. He has all these passwords from American University. Yeah. And he'll print out the paper for you, you know. So he'll download for you and print it, you know. So I realized, of course, there's a lot of exchange of memory sticks and all that, you know, PDF files and all that, you know, that, you know, and that every academic having a memory stick is very important, but that's how they get these things circulated without being online. So they find their ways around these things, you know.
I should say that at first listen, I thought that he was preening a little about how everyone has read his papers, but then he hauls my attention to the actual point of how these Kenyan students are thirsting for knowledge and finding a way past the obstacles to access. I'll pull just one more sliver out of this to conclude.
I think the general story that for economists especially, well, not all social scientists, history matters, you know, it matters a lot, you know. And you see it when people ignore your history, that it really, really does a lot of damage. And that, I think, even what we've been trying to do in our lectures, just to make students be aware that, you know, this time passes, you know, and that is a general problem. We should be this timeless theorizing about society, you know, that makes sense.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense in general.
Yeah,
that,
yeah. You know? I read a really nice article this week by the second author is Ravenhill, and it's called Beyond Product Cycles and Flying Geese.
Oh, okay, yes. No, I'm not reading that.
It's from 1996.
Oh, okay.
But the point of it is that Japan, like, people aren't, Asian countries aren't replicating the Japanese model.
No.
Because Japan kind of retained the sort of more knowledge intensive activities.
Yes.
And outsourced other activities.
Yes.
So it's not like other countries vacate the stage, right? The stage is always changing.
Yes.
Challenge is always changing.
That, in a sense, was the...
I've been thinking about this. The question of development pathways a lot while listening to the noisy but somewhat foolish debate over Africa's right to exploit its fossil fuel reserves. Kind of like we haven't had our turn on the greenhouse gas emissions swing yet, and so it would be unfair not to let us to. As Professor Mann says, the economies and societies whose development paths some are so tempted to try to follow, well, those pathways haven't been vacated. You do ask yourself if the plan for the sequel to Europe is to also enact a version of the transatlantic slave trade and colonization along with drilling for oil. Misquoting Frantz Fanon, Aydren, we can do anything so long as we do not imitate Europe. I come away from this interview thinking about how important it is to look at reality and how African societies are actually functioning and misfunctioning and how this came to be. And that is how we start to come to grips with the question of how Africans get what they need and want while protecting the most vulnerable among us and the ecology that everything ultimately rests on. And switching gears somewhat, Nandjira Sanbuli is a researcher, policy analyst, and strategist who's interested in the gendered impacts of the adoption of new information and communication technologies. She's here speaking to a couple of LSE postgraduate students, and they start by asking her about the situation with the use and misuse of data in Africa.
Oh, it's bad. This is the easiest one to put it. And, you know, again, you know, sometimes when it comes to digital and data, a lot of people try to advance this ahistoricity to it as if it's not situated in the present and the past dimensions and dynamics and relationships that have existed. And so for Africa, the rest of the world, it's just another theater through which we are seeing the typical development tropes, the typical historical imbalances and injustices, if you will, now being extended to what is supposedly a technical lens, which is through digital and data. So by and large, Africa as a continent is still not very connected. We're talking about approximately 25% of African mm-hmm. citizens who are connected to the internet, for example. And so a lot of actors see potential to connect that other 75% with, you know, great population growth trajectories if COVID does not disrupt those numbers too much. It's a great market potential, and you see this also in other developing regions and continents as well. So there's a lot of interest to, you know, draw out and get business from those who are already connected, but also to connect those who are unconnected, and within that, being underlined by this data economy.
Who are the actors that are active within this digital data field?
Very generally, you could, every actor. So you have governments in their bilateral or regional relationships with African countries playing a part in that, typically through international development instruments. You have the geopolitical dimension where you have the West versus China versus even new emerging actors like India who are showcasing interest in the continent, and in its markets. You also see private sector companies from all corners of the world, including local innovation communities, all sort of converging to get a piece of this data economy pie.
Also, I was just going to ask you, why do you think this context of data extractivism is particularly harmful in Africa? You mentioned historical imbalances. Do you think that these are the same factors that have been in play over time?
Pretty much. And, you know, part of what's happening, as with other conversations around what are public goods, what are global commons, data and the digital economy is still about a winner takes all. So whether it's a government through international development or a tech company from one corner of the world going in on something as technical a field as education or health or agriculture, they're coming at it with, we have to get discover this place, lock these people and their ideas and what they need into our systems, use that to then, you know, be the person or the actor on whom people rely to get access to certain stuff, and the barriers to move from one, tool or one solution to another are pretty steep. So you're pretty much locked in. And this is more broadly what we've seen as the digital economy and the data economy that we're existing in.
If you think about what role can data play for development, and like what are the risks or the downsides that come along with it?
So we see a lot of, let's get data to help make more informed choices, to help with better planning, to help with cost savings, to help with you name it. We've seen all the top lines and the pitches. But the devil is often in the details, and that's where the challenge is. And usually it's a difficult conversation to have with a lot of people, because people still want to believe that this is it. This is the panacea. This is what Africa has been waiting for. This is what any developing country or any community that has been left behind has waited for or needed the whole time. The thing about data and any tools that can help you get all this data about people, personal, intimate, or proxy aggregations of people to help predict and all of that, is a sense of control. Now, there are very many actors out there, whether they're in the state, private sector, or other configuration, who want power. And so they'll do whatever it takes to get it if it's going to serve a particular interest they have.
Okay, and how do you see data be able to contribute in a positive way?
You know, it's not yet another app. Typically what we've seen is, if you look at over, say, the last 10 years of digital developments, it's always been the flavor of the season. Maybe a couple of years ago was mobile led to open data. Mobile and open data was supposed to give us something that didn't quite work out. Enter new fancy technologies, somewhere between AI, blockchain, fourth industrial revolution, you name it. And now COVID, we keep thinking more data, as opposed to actually understanding there are underlying issues that we have not been at. Those systemic issues and systemic thinking is what we necessarily need to start doing. So whether through the theories we advance, the way we study these things, the way we talk about them, how we accommodate what we don't know, is some of the things that can help us make sure we do not fast track what is right now looking like it could be a net bad as opposed to a net good.
What do you think the role of states is in prioritizing both this thinking and doing, aligning technologies with, you know, what's appropriate for the context? How can the state mediate this extractiveness of private sector behavior that we're seeing?
We need all states to go back to being custodians of the public interest, right? Yeah. That's what it is, because we can keep giving, we can create blockchain versions of these very problematic governments we have. It's not going to change anything. So when we talk about whether it's innovation or regulation or the role of governments as regulation, it has to be centered in the fact that they need to be custodians of public interest. One function, you know, in the tech world, talking about regulation has almost been like the word, you know, it's like a Voldemort, the word that shall not be named, the R word, if you will. And that's because it's always been this narrative that we're punishing innovation if we go about regulation. But one unstated and understated function of regulation is indeed consumer protection, which is a government's job because we elect them, or we try to now, bots and data can, apparently. But we need to restore the function of the state, which was we elect as the function of giving consent to these instruments. We pay taxes, we do all this to make sure our benefits and, I mean, our interests are, you know, protected. We absolutely have to make sure we reform the state to go back to that. But fashioning states in the function of private sector and businesses has been complicating the fact that they should be doing that. And so if we do not start changing pace with that, and I think, you know, funny enough, it's strange that we're living in a world where COVID determines everything, but we've seen where the role of a state is needed. If they had not stepped in, there's no innovation that's going to save us. Otherwise, we'll never afford to come out of lockdown. We've seen the need for the state. And so we should use that to gain trajectory and recalibrate what they should be able to do, which is consider and put into action all the suggestions, all the the laws that we've put in place to actually protect our interests and make sure that whatever is put out there is serving citizens as opposed to squeezing them further.
Okay. So just have one final question. And this is just kind of going back to the central issue of this podcast, which is all about knowledge and knowledge production. So what we're going to ask is, like, what do you think are the mechanisms which really contribute to this whole data extraction process being seen as reinforcing these dependencies between local and external expertise, and perhaps even how does power shape this notion of expertise, and how can we challenge that?
The expert question.
Sorry, I'm just leaving you.
It's a good one. It's also such a kryptonite, because I don't know. I guess the fight will always remain. How do we then think of expertise as everybody's an expert of their lived experience and everybody has something to contribute? My contributions are not more equal than yours, but in a certain context, mine might need to be prioritized or yours might need to be prioritized. It goes back to history. We're not starting these things in a vacuum. We're not developing these tools. We're not developing systems in vacuums. There are all these histories that we have not resolved that carry on. So that even when it comes to something as like expertise, which we want to think of it as technical, is very shrouded in gender dynamics, in racial dynamics, in you name it, any dynamic has a factor to play on who's considered an expert or not. Heck, the fact that maybe I can put two English words together and sounds like a buzzword makes me an expert overnight, over somebody who's been saying it in a longer way, is very telling about how we value these things. Say a bunch of LSE students come to Nairobi, they buy folks a couple of drinks, they get information, they go write a book, and they become the experts that are consulted, say by DFID. That's a typical economy. That's real talk. It's happening. It's just that now COVID, again, travel has been disrupted. So webinars are it.
What a great reputation. Follow this.
Yeah. Or even brands like LSE. You know, you can have an afternoon, suddenly you're an expert over me and my University of Nairobi degree. That's some real stuff that's happening over here.
Yeah.
So respect. You know, the thing is, human values, and they keep being invoked. We talk about inclusiveness. We talk about diversity. What they actually mean in practice remains a secret source, and really making sure we breathe life to them. And that remains an evergreen challenge. I think the most interesting theaters are around these unquantifiable things that cannot fit machine learning tools, that cannot fit all these technical fixes we want. It's not because those technical fixes will not work, but for them to truly have the potential they have, for good and bad, we have to situate them in the real world theater that is messy, that is untidy, that has histories, that is also driven by good ideas. I think at the end of the day, no one just wants to blow us into smithereens and we don't exist. I think it's really who, everyone, everywhere they are, how do they get to actually contribute to the kind of future they want to see? And how do they do that in context that they do not exist in the world alone? No man or woman is an island.
Pazenda la kumzambo, pazenda la kumzambo, guba
Well, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, that's it for Amanda Radio this week here at CQUT 90.3 FM Montreal, CQUT Radio. And we are thankful to Taina Grousset for putting together that piece on the role of economists and IT people and data-driven work in Africa. We'll be having more from him in the future, as well as from Daraja Press. We thank everybody at CQT for keeping the show going and hope they have good holidays when the season starts in the next couple of weeks. And we ask you all to stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium.
Up the tree, decorate the tree, make a gift list, invite the in-laws, drop off the canned goods, find that fruitcake recipe for the office party, plan the dinner for Christmas Eve, decorate the house, hang the stockings, wrap the presents, ask Lucas to clean up his room, do the groceries, bake cookies, right. Go get vaccinated.
The holidays are fast approaching. Get vaccinated against COVID-19 now so you'll be protected in time. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Hello, bonjour, hola. Welcome to the first edition of Turbulent Through the Andes Mountain, a show inside the fabulous World Skip the Beat program. Today, we will travel through the southernmost American diasporas and dystopian pre-Cordillera and ravine that shaped the synth-pop electronic scene of Chile and Argentina during the late 70s and late 80s, between valleys of darkness, repression, but at the same time light and nostalgia. By the first hour, we will listen to music of Arquitectos del Río, the Argentinian band Sumo, the Chilean band Pinochet Boys, another Chilean band Los Blobs, also Electrodomésticos, Aparato Raro, Los Prisioneros,